This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. My name is Celeste Quinn. Our guest this afternoon in this portion of the program is poet Patricia Smith. She says poetry is the way she processes the world, and she thanks her father, Otis Douglas Smith, for her gift. He was a storyteller, and she has written of him, "Because of him, I grew to think of the world in terms of the stories it could tell. From my father's moonlit tales of steaming Delta magic to the sweet solo songs of Smokey Robinson, I became addicted to unfolding drama, winding narrative threads, the lyricism of simple words." Smith, who is considered one of the key figures of slam, is our guest this afternoon. We'll talk with her about her poetry and her latest collection of poems, Tea House of the Almighty. Patricia Smith is in Champaign-Urbana as part of the Carr Reading Series of the University of Illinois Creative Writing Program. She'll read from her work this afternoon, the 2nd of November at 4:30, in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Patricia?
Yes.
Hi.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
To begin, would you please read a poem? And I would like to suggest the first poem that is in the collection, Tea House of the Almighty.
All right, and I'm going to say one little thing about this poem.
Okay.
Okay. I did a residency in Miami for a number of years. I first came to do it with a group of sixth graders, and then I was invited back year after year, so I got to see the kids grow up. And when I first walked into the class and I come bounding in saying, "Well, I'm here to teach you poetry," the area that I was in had a high incidence of drug use, so a lot of kids had lost parents or brothers and sisters to AIDS, and they're looking at me like, "Well, that's all well and good, but how can you make our lives better?" And there was a little girl there whose mother had died the week before, and she was already back in school. And unlike some of the things that we see where, you know, something traumatic happens to the kids and they rush the psychologist in and they worry about the kid's emotional state, well, that wasn't happening. I mean, she was just back in school. And as I proceeded with the poetry workshop, she said, "Well, can you teach me to write a poem about my mama?" You know, because she'd heard all these bad things and her mother was a drug addict. And she said, "And I had really special moments with my mother and I want to remember those." So I put this poem first in the book, and I also do it first almost every reading that I do because it reminds me of how powerful poetry is, that it could take you from one place in your head to a safer place. And that's what basically she was asking that it do for her. So it's a poem that's dedicated to my kids. She's in college now, by the way. That's how old I am. Dedicated to my kids. And I have to say this. They made me promise to say it every time I did the poem. This is dedicated to the sixth grade class at Lily C. Evans Elementary School in Dade County, Miami. There, I fulfill my duty. I am astonished at their mouthful names, Lakanisha, Chevalane, DeLeo, Fumaleo. Their ragged rebellions and lip gloss pouts and all those pants drooped as drapery. I rejoice when they kiss my face, whisper wet and urgent in my ear, make me their obsession because I have brought them poetry. They shout me raw, bruise my wrist with their pulling, and brashly claim me as mama as they cradle my head in their little laps, waiting for new words to grow in my mouth. You. 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 Angry, jubilant, weeping poets, we are all saviors, reluctant hosannas in the limelight, but you knew that, didn't you? So let us bless this sixth grade class. 40 cracking voices, 40 nappy heads, and all of them raise their hands when I ask. They have all seen the Reaper, grim in his heavy robe, pushing the button for the dead project elevator, begging for a break at the corner pawn shop, cackling wildly in the back pew of the Baptist church. I ask the death question, and 40 fists punch the air. Me! Me! An O'Neill matchstick crack child watched his mother's body become a claw. And 9-year-old Tico Jefferson, barely big enough to lift the gun, fired a bullet into his throat when Mama bended his back with a lead pipe. Tamika cried into a sofa pillow when Daddy blasted Mama into the north wall of their cluttered one-room apartment. Danya's cousin, gone in a drive-by. Dark window. Click, click, gone, says Danya, her tiny finger a barrel, the thumb a hammer. I am astonished at their losses. And yet when I read a poem about my own hard-eyed teenager, Jeffrey asks, is he dead yet? Cannot be comprehended. An 18-year-old still pushing and pulling his own breath. And 40 faces pity me, knowing that I will soon be as they are, numb to our bloodied histories, favoring the Reaper with a thumbs up and a wink, hearing the question and shouting, me, me, Miss Smith, I know somebody dead. Can poetry hurt us, they ask me, before crawling into my words to sleep. I love you, Nicole says. Nicole wearing my face, pimples peppering her nose, and she is as black as angels are. Nicole's braids kissed with match flame to seal them. And can you teach me to write a poem about my mama, Miss Smith? I mean, you write about your daddy, and he's dead. Can you teach me to remember my mama? A teacher tells me this is the first time Nicole has admitted that her mother is gone. Murdered by slim silver needles and a stranger rifling through her blood, the virus pushing her skeleton through for Nicole to see. And now this child with rusty knees and mismatched shoes sees poetry as her scream and asks me for the words to build her mother again, replacing the voice, stitching on the lost flesh. So poets, as we take the stage, as we flirt and sin and rejoice behind microphones, remember Nicole. She knows that we are here now, and she is an empty vessel waiting to be filled. And she is waiting. And she's waiting. And she waits.
Mm. Building Nicole's Mama from Tea House of the Almighty. What was it like to be in the presence of those children?
Well, it's something, there's a progression when you start to write poetry. I think at the beginning, it's all I believe, I see, I think, I feel. Then you move out and you start commenting on the larger world. And this will be, you know, response to news events, things that anger you or sadden you or something. But then when you come back to yourself, it's with a poet's eyes. And then you realize that there are people who, we're all born with that second throat. And the only thing that happens, only difference between me and someone who doesn't write is something happened in my life to click that loose. When I sat there and looked at those kids and realized that I had gone through my entire school career without ever having someone come into a class and say, this is what I do, and it's an option that's available for you. Your voices are legitimate. Every voice is legitimate. That my life would have been changed that much sooner if that had happened. And the trauma that our kids suffer, you know, I mean, just everyday trauma in some of their cases, and not having an outlet for that. And so just going in and saying, you know, putting pen to paper, although it might be something you scoff at now, it's a very healing process. It's something that can open other conversational avenues if there are things, you know, and you don't always have to take to your fist, or, you know, it doesn't have to be a confrontation all the time. It can be something that you settle quietly within yourself. And that was a big concept, a huge concept for those kids.
Yeah.
And I love doing that over and over again in different schools.
Yeah. I also feel within that poem a request, a caution, and a demand on your part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're talking to poets, but you're also talking to everyone.
Right. Well, just in thinking of this girl's story, it was like, I have a story I need to tell. I have someone I need to remember, and I need a way to do that. And there are people who do it now, but they're not talking to me. When I first got introduced to poetry, I got introduced by getting up on stage and doing it. And it was a great thing. It was a social circle. I had a wonderful time. I was meeting all these incredible people. But at some point, for every audience that I stand in front of, there's at least one person who needs to hear something I'm going to do. And it may be a line that's inconsequential in the poem, but it's something that they grasp onto, and it opens up something for them. And it sounds kind of haughty at first. It's like, well, something in my poem is going. And that's not really what I mean. I just mean, when I talked about whatever clicked my voice loose, it can take something very small to do that for another person. So while there are a lot of us who are going out to open mics and, you know, looking for teaching jobs and trying to get on television and making spoken word CDs and all that, that I think we need to just go back and think of that first time when you did a reading and someone came up and said, I have felt that way. I just didn't know there was a way to express it. And that there's a responsibility that comes along. If this is something you choose to do, surely you can do it recreationally for a while and move on to something else. But if you decide to build your life around it, it comes with an obligation. And that's what I thought at the end of that I could say, I've told you this girl's story. Now you need to realize that there are millions of her, you know, and they're all waiting for someone like you to come and tell them that the life they're living is okay.
Yeah. And that's really the responsibility of all the arts. It's the job of the arts, isn't it?
It should be. It's so easy to get away from it now. I mean, the thing that I was introduced to poetry by being in a poetry slam, which was this hugely commercial, entertaining thing, you know. But the way I look at it is you may read about the poetry slam and go, oh, well, that sounds trendy and quirky. Let's go and have a few drinks and watch it. You know, but what it's doing is it's like a big fish hook that we throw out. And you pull it in, and sure, there's, you know, party people are clinging to it. But then there's one person who is going to then turn to the person next to them and say, who do you read? Or do you know if there are other places like this I can go? Where can I go to read my own poetry? And they become bona fide members of poetry audiences. And those are the people that then will go on to realize what other things poetry can accomplish.
Mm.
And that's what you want. So, you know, even the aspects of it that are entertaining. And I do collaborations with visual artists and collaborations with musicians to make it palatable, to get people into the room, to say, you know, you're going to spend an evening of entertainment. But then, you know, when it's over and they're not getting out of their seats because they're thinking, I've just heard something. I've just heard a story told a different way. And that lets me know that, you know, I can go down that avenue. And you really want that. You really want that. When I get calls from other people, and I used to think what I did was very insular, that people, I'm originally from Chicago, and so that people in Chicago would hear it and they, you know, talk about it. But I get calls from all over the country, and people have just kind of picked up the book and found something in there that speaks directly to them and wants you to know about it. So you have to realize that your voice is very public. And I was talking earlier in a class about revealing a lot of myself in my poems. And I think that's a decision that you have to make. That if you're going to write from behind a very thin wall about your experiences, or if you're going to say, what other chance do I have to to roll this out and look at, take a really hard look at it and see what it actually was. So now I'm going back into earlier moments in my life and just sort of reexamining them as a poet, which a lot of other things that I didn't realize at first come to the surface because that's the way I see things now. And so there's an obligation I have to myself, too. I mean, it's an examined life. It's a closely examined life. And I want to recreate that life as much as I can for other people who are need to do that with their own lives and so say, or can have the courage to write about a son in jail or a failed marriage or, you know. I mean, that's why. I mean, I think if we had writing workshops in, like, post offices, you wouldn't get people shooting the post office up so often, you know. I mean, you just need outlets. We're like little pressure cookers walking around all the time. And we just don't feel like we can share. We hold everything inside. And this was a totally liberating thing for me, discovering not only poetry as a social outlet, but as a personal way of moving my life into safer spaces.
Mm. It's amazing to think that someone like yourself, who words are what you're all about, didn't discover poetry until you went to a poetry slam. Tell us a little bit more then about how you went from, did you go as someone who was going to be in the audience, or did you go as, I'm going to get up there? how did you make that, you know, go
I
from?
I went to a huge poetry festival in Chicago, and I was one of those people that was just going to go and have a couple of drinks and laugh at the poets. It was 5 hours, 50 poets, winter afternoon blues club. Wow. Okay, so I thought, and I had a couple of people with me, and I went, and I mean, I've always believed that if you say you're impassioned about writing, you should write in as many ways as you can. I think we draw these thick lines between genres that really shouldn't be there. And so I go into this place, and it was supposed to be an event that mixed academic poets and street poets and students, so you get to hear a wide variety of voices. And two things happened. One was I was very surprised that there was a huge, vibrant literary community in Chicago that I knew nothing about, creative literary community. And second, there was this woman sitting in the front, and she looked vaguely familiar, and I wasn't quite sure who she was. And she's sitting there very patiently waiting her turn. And then she got introduced, and it was Gwendolyn Brooks. And when she read, she sat back down. She was accessible to all the, you know, there were high school students there, and she stayed there for the whole 5-hour event. And I couldn't wait to be a part of that or to see where else is this going on. And then the poems were so different from what I imagined. People were reading about things that we talked about, you know, things that you just saw in the news, moments in their own lives that you could identify with. It was accessible. The language was immediate. It was so exciting to find that. And so right away I wanted to be part of it. And there was a young man at the door with a clipboard. And I said, he's a person I should. He was checking people in that were reading. And his name was Michael Warren. He was a great literary organizer in Chicago. And he kind of took me around to different venues to introduce me. And one of the first places he took me was the place where the slam was. And you have to understand about the evening at the slam, it's a open mic, very non-pressure, anybody who signs up, a featured poet that they bring in. And the slam is tacked on to the end of the evening. So if the slam's not your thing, you still have a full evening of poetry, you can leave. And I was just all fixated on the open mic. So, oh my God, I can't believe that these people are reading what they're reading. And, you know, I had a couple of poems I had done. I was clutching, you know. And eventually I got up and read in the open. And I think there's a moment that happens where you're in the middle of a poem and you're either thinking, I can't wait till this is over and I'm never going to do it again. Or you discover something within yourself that actually likes it. And you're listening to your own voice and going, wow, you know. And then I was hearing things in other people's poems that inspired me, and all the topics got flying at me and all the possibilities. And I would watch the slam kind of, you know, sitting there with my mouth hanging open, because not only were these people very proficient, you know, the craft was great, but there was a bit of drama to it. It was wonderful. And I said, oh my God, I could never. But what I figured out about myself is I have a real competitive streak. And I did not know this before. And I said, I'm going to try that. I'm going to do that, you know. And once I did it, I wanted to be like the best at doing it. So I just kept studying people, and eventually, and I owe it so much, because while a lot of people will say, oh, you can't do poetry and performance, and they just take it way too seriously, it's not really a serious thing. It's a, you know, it's a crapshoot, basically. But it gave me so much confidence in terms of audiences. It opened up it opened my eyes so that every single thing I look at has the potential for poem. And now that I don't slam anymore, I would say that I owe where I am and what I do to both the people who were involved at the slam in the beginning and just to that environment. Just gave me a lot of confidence. And, you know, now I'm reading with people who have, you know, won Pulitzers and poet laureates and things like that. And I no longer feel like I'm down here looking up when I'm in their presence. You know, it made me feel like my voice was just as legitimate. I just came at it from another direction, but I owe it quite a bit.
When you first started out with the slam, what was going on in the rest of your life?
When did I start with the slam? Okay, I have to place myself in that year. What was going on with the rest of my life? I was working at a newspaper, and which is... what newspaper was that? Was it
the Sun Times?
Chicago. Yep, I was at Chicago Sun Times, and trying to build a creative life that had those two parallel things going on, because it's always been an issue with people whether or not journalists have any creativity at all, and whether the two can coincide. You know, I used to have parties at my house, and the journalists would be on one side and the poets on the other, and they'd be glaring at each other like, you know, wait a minute, don't you all use words, you know? It was interesting because I was getting a lot of topics from my poems, from my journalism, and then a lot of my journalism had poetic elements in it, so they were feeding each other very well. And I started to think of it as two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, that makes me think of Boy Dies, Girlfriend Gets His Heart.
Yeah, this definitely came from a news story.
Yeah, the there's an Associated Press clipping, so to speak, right, at the top of the poem in Tea House of the Almighty. A 15-year-old boy who learned that his girlfriend needed a heart transplant told his mother 3 weeks ago that he was going to die and that the girl should have his heart. Felipe Garza, who his brother said had seemed in perfect health, died Saturday after a blood vessel burst in his head. His family followed his wishes, and Felipe's heart was transplanted Sunday into Donna Ashlock.
I mean, you read that, and there are news stories that that just stay with us. You know, I'm always looking at news stories and poems as snapshots. So that's a snapshot in that person's life, in those people's lives. But then you begin to think of the story before that and the story after that. And then to find out that, you know, the girl's body began to reject the heart. And to me, it just was a love story. You know, I mean, it was the ultimate love story. And then she, you know, eventually just the heart didn't work. But I can open any newspaper and find something that it was born to be examined creatively. Mm. You know, some of the stories. And a lot of them are just when you see something huge like Katrina or September 11th, or, you know, in order to get through an event like that, sometimes you really have to step into the center of it and just write until it comes to, you calm yourself with the writing, because there's no other way it's going to make sense to you, you know.
Would you like to read this or
sure.
recite this for for our listeners this
that.
Afternoon? Poet Patricia Smith, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine.
Okay, now I'm going to repeat what you said.
Okay, you'll probably do a much better job.
Yeah, you did fine. I thought you were going to read the whole thing. I was like, wow, go. Patterson, California, Associated Press. A 15-year-old boy who learned that his girlfriend needed a heart transplant told his mother 3 weeks ago that he was going to die and that the girl should have his heart. Felipe Garza, who his brother said had seemed in perfect health, died Saturday after a blood vessel burst in his head. His family followed his wishes, and Felipe's heart was transplanted Sunday into Donna Ashlock. The deep things we know. How systems grow restless and damning in us, stunning the machine, and what we feel. The head romances us, coos ancient wooings, makes us want to lie back and listen to the failures, the bones thinning, fat clogging the paths. Outside us, what? Some opening waiting to scar over, some flower peeled open, its drum growing slow. And suddenly, the least we can do is us. Patterson, California, Associated Press. A 17-year-old girl who 3 years ago received the heart of a boyfriend who died needs a new heart because her body is rejecting the transplanted organ. Doctors are looking for a suitable heart for Donna Ashlock, who has been living with the heart of Felipe Garza since January 4, 1986. Doctors learned last month that the Garza heart has been permanently damaged by Donna's body's repeated attempts to reject it. I want this earth out of me, this conjured world, this wire, this battery, this button. I would rather the suddening stoplight, the dawned silence. Beat it backwards, shoot it through with slivers of glass, chop it from its walls. Arise it beyond me, make it arc over my dead head like a heaven. Imagine the given thing being all that you are. Imagine a machine's steel tear. Know how I know this cannot be my heart. It loves me too much. Patterson, California, Associated Press. Donna Ashlock, the 17-year-old girl whose body rejected the transplanted heart of a boyfriend, died Tuesday while waiting for a new heart. Heaven is a room without air, tinier than you would expect. Their harbors summarily discarded, souls are smashed upon souls, writhing, lit neon with overwhelms of holy. Here, names, crimes, and choices are forgotten. There is only one door, and the harried souls hurtle through, bargain for space, pulse gleefully. The fickle, treacherous heart is a need no one misses. In heaven, they keep one beating in a cage, purely for show.
Thanks.
You're welcome. I hardly ever read that. Thank you.
You're welcome. Poet Patricia Smith, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. She's a recipient of the Carl Sandburg Award for Poetry. She's also a four-time National Poetry Slam champion. Competitive.
Very competitive.
She was featured in the film Slam Nation and on the HBO series Deaf Poetry Jam. She's in Champaign-Urbana as part of the Carr Reading Series of the University of Illinois Creative Writing Program, and she will read from her work this afternoon, the 2nd of November, at 4:30 in the Author's Corner of the Illini Union Bookstore. Tea House of the Almighty is her fourth collection of poems. She's also the author of the children's book, Jana and the Kings, and co-author of Africans in America, America's Journey Through Slavery. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with a question or a comment. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, when I introduced you, I mentioned your father.
Mm-hmm.
Otis Douglas Smith.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for saying his name on the radio. I was so happy to hear that.
It's a great name, and mm-hmm. he apparently was quite a guy. Tell us about him.
I have no brothers or sisters, and my parents, when they came up from the South, were very much in awe of the city, but also a little frightened by it, and wanted to try to figure out how to raise a child. My mother and father, I have no idea how they came together, how they even met each other. My mother's a very straight-laced, Baptist, God-fearing, not a very emotionally giving person, very staunch. And yeah, my father was a total opposite, you know, a born blues singer. I mean, he loved singing. He loved telling stories, gathering in the evening, just kind of thinking, oh, I remember when, and I hear these great Southern stories. And he, what you said before in the introduction about making me think of the world in terms of stories it could tell, that was my dad. And while I knew I wanted to do something with writing, with my life, my mother was very practical, and the greatest I could aspire to, according to her, was being a teacher or a nurse. Teacher, nurse, teacher, nurse. And while those are wonderful professions, it just held no interest for me at all at the time. And my father would then, you know, take me out in the kitchen and go, you can be anything you want. You know, he wouldn't say it loud enough for my mother to hear, but. And everything I do now is directly related to my dad, the spirit of my father, and what he never said. I mean, at one point, people were telling me, well, yeah, you really just writing for a living. Black people don't do that. What? And why would that be? You know? And so my mother was more afraid. My father, while he was very careful with his own life, they both worked in candy factory for like 40 years. He was determined to set me free, to sort of, you know, take the leashes off and go run, see what happens. And that's what, you know, that's what I do, you know. And I sometimes will be in the middle of a reading and I will be in some amazing space where I open my eyes and people that I've read for years are sitting in the audience, or I'm on a stage on a podium or something, and I look down the row and there's, you know, a Pulitzer, and I, my God, my dad, look what happened, look where I am. You know, my mother still is very strange about it. She's still, the idea of getting paid for creative work is not in my mother's head at all. It's like, you want to work at the post office? You punch a clock, you get paid every Friday, you get good benefits. The idea of getting paid in spurts, or, oh, I'm getting this for a book and then I'm not getting anything else for 2 months, I'll do a reading, I'll get... My mother still cannot connect. And the idea that I write about very personal things and read them out loud, so she's still kind of shuddered about this whole thing. But I can hear my dad all the time, you know, because this is what I told him when I was like 8 or 9 years old, that I just wanted to write.
Well, you wrote an article when you were in a real rough patch of your life for Essence, and your mom's mentioned in there, and she said, go pick up your unemployment check, and maybe they're hiring today down at the post office.
And she was serious.
But, you know, in a sense, sometimes, you know, sometimes that's just what you need, too.
Well, yeah, if you, I mean.
You know what I'm saying?
I don't blame people for presenting that as an option, because you kind of need to get down to something that's rote, some mechanical kind of, you know.
Yeah, but essentially the message was, you know, pick yourself up and
pick yourself up, you know, before you're rooting through dumpsters for food. It never sort of came to that. And actually, my rough patch, when I got fired from my journalism job, I was talking about that earlier today. And people right away demanded to know why it had happened. And I didn't know. I mean, I knew it was my fault. I knew that I had taken great risk with what people thought was a really fantastic job. And it was in a lot of ways. But it was a very torturous path. And where it led me to a point where I had no options except to write creatively. And so I'm thinking it was a long way around to get me to what I should have probably been writing in the first place. You know, but the whole thing, the public sense of it and the humiliation and all that, my mother, who's a very private person, she just, you know, will go move to another city and get a public service job. And, you know, and two things happened. One was the poetry, the creative community was there all the time when I sort of retreated and didn't speak to anyone and was sort of disappeared. They didn't stop until they found me, you know, and some of them were rough. Some of them were very kind of confront me about it. And so, But it was still, even that was nurturing in a way, because I did have people say to me, well, now that you can't write for a newspaper, what are you going to do? No, now that you can no longer write, what are you going to do with your life? And I said, well, that's arrogant, you know. And I, for a while, I just felt there will be nothing else. I can't do anything else. I mean, this is all I've ever thought of. And at that stage, the poetry life had grown kind of in parallel with the journalism thing. And so it was there and it was waiting. And I had a lot of more rough patches to go to before I just kind of really accepted it and said, this is where I need to be.
Yeah. There's a poem in this new collection, Tea House of the Almighty, called Stop the Presses.
Yeah.
I don't know if you'd like to read that. Or,
sure. I have no problem with that.
Or talk about, that seems to me, in that poem, you're doing what we started out talking about, you know, building your way out of something, finding your voice.
Right.
Building, working. So maybe you would talk about that poem and then read it.
Sure. It's part of, there's a whole, God, I would probably think to about 40 poems that I wrote during that tough time. And it was when I realized that was going to be my salvation. And there's stuff, I mean, I read them for a while, but they were just mostly for me. It was almost like journaling. And I think this is one of the more palatable ones, you know, that's kind of more of a general, it's not so much, you know, me sweating it out. It's more of a general comment on...
It speaks to the difficulties, I think, of what it is maybe to do that daily work.
To do the daily work, to be confronted with that empty canvas every day, and to be thrust into other people's lives. I don't mind being thrust in and living that life along with them for a while, but then you got to go, you know? And it was like...
Yeah, it's the next story. Yeah, it's the next day.
And there's another poem that I have where it talks about a ritual that a lot of reporters have to go through where there's been some sort of a disaster or, you know, someone's gotten killed and you try to be the first person at the door of the family. And knocking on that door and just not knowing what's going to happen when you're let inside. And you have to, like, plop yourself down in the middle of that grief. But on one hand, you're feeling the grief. On the other hand, you're looking for the lead for your peace. So, it's hard to be that person, you know. Anyway, Stop the Presses. My job is to draw the pictures no one else can voice, to soothe and bellow toward the numbed heart, to breathe in your chronicles, discuss them out in lines weak enough for you to read and swallow. My mouth is a jumble of canine teeth. I bite only at the official whistle. My job is sexy leads for the bones clattering in your closet, to sing you sated each night with a forgettable soundtrack of paper and ink. I am neat, easily folded, a sifter of truth born to be burned. I count your dead, fathom their stories, bless them with long, flexible histories and their final names. There are no soft stanzas in this city of curb sleep and murdered children. We need soft words for hard things, this silk brushing the inevitability of rock. Birth truth in this way, just once. Craft the news and overcome all that you ever were, a reason to turn the page.
Stop the Presses. Before we run out of time, I want to ask you about Gwendolyn Brooks. You mentioned her.
Sure.
And she appears in at least two poems.
She'll be in more.
I had the great privilege, honor of meeting her, and she was with some kids.
Always. That's what I love about
her. She was at the library, and she was surrounded by children, and she was so generous. But she was also demanding. This is how this word is spelled. She was working with them on working on poetry. Mm-hmm. Here's, you know, we can be creative, but there's a way in which we do this.
Right.
What did you learn from her about craft?
Well, I've always just been jolted by Gwendolyn's language. Just that she could see an ordinary word and twist it. And so you're affected by about five things at once. The sound of the word, the new definition that she has created, the way it sits so perfectly with the rest of the words in the line, the way that line twists the whole poem. I mean, there would be all these things going on at once. And then you'd see her come walking into a reading with, her stockings rolled up under her knees and her head wrapped up in her Coke bottle specs, and you're looking at the poems,
little
and looking
old lady,
at the woman,
yeah.
and believing that there are indeed some people who are just born to this. Just some, that from the moment I talk about learning to look at life with a poet's eyes, I think some people are just born with those eyes. And her reaching back constantly and saying to the children, because I know a lot of poets, so-called, quote, famous, unquote poets, who will, plop in and do a workshop and say, I've now influenced the children, But she just lived her life around them. And yes, she had a bit of the school marm in her. Said, you'll do this, but you'll do this correctly.
Right.
And there's just not enough of that. I mean, I kind of go into schools and say, okay, whatever I need to do to convince you have a legitimate voice, I don't care if the words are spelled right. I don't care how the line breaks are. I don't care if you write it on your arm instead of the paper. I don't care, But then at some point, you're going to have to say, now we're going to introduce discipline. And she was a very, very disciplined writer. But also, what I think my initial connection was that she was very much a Chicago colored girl. She wrote about the kind, the tenement life that, I grew up in, where I grew up as a kid, and what those realities are when you left your home and had to walk down to the street corners, and what kind of music was pouring out of the windows, and, what kind of, street talk you heard, or, sitting in the barbershop or and it was, she knows my life. She knows my life. And so that led me to go, okay, let's see how much more of me she's captured, and go to all of it. And she was just the most accessible person. So when people say to me, well, I can't believe you're here. You're famous. First of all, I'm not famous, and I can't believe you came into this school and you're not getting paid. And I can't, well, we're poets, but we can't forget what poetry is and how it's supposed to be in the faces and ears of the people who need it the most. And she's a perfect example of that. Perfect example. I mean, I can't remember anything where Gwendolyn did something where for the sole purpose of advancing Gwendolyn. There are still in Chicago, the Gwendolyn Brooks open mic contest, mm-hmm. and, their whole school competitions named after her. And you've got kids that are in elementary school who know her, who said, I saw her. She came into my class. She signed this poem I have. She told me I was a good writer. She left so much of herself here. And that people will, kids especially, will just kind of sit back and say, Gwendolyn Brooks took the time to tell me that I had promise, or she was in my class, and a whole generation of poets are going to be coming up, sort of worshiping at the Church of Gwen.
And even if you didn't, never met her or saw her, on the page, she's very much there.
You will know her, and I would say you would know her if you've read her, and I don't mean that you have to do a lot of reading. But, yeah, about two or three poems, and you go, oh, my God, what an amazing woman.
Yeah. Good place to stop. We have to stop.
Oh, sure. I've had a great time.
Well, good.
Thanks.
Patricia Smith has been my guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Her latest collection of poetry is Tea House of the Almighty. She's in Champaign-Urbana on the campus as part of the Carr Reading Series of the University of Illinois Creative Writing Program, and she will read from her work this afternoon, the 2nd of November at 4:30 in the Author's Corner of the Alana Union Bookstore. Thank you very much.
Thank you.